try to tempt you into reading one of these papers. I suggest you read this one because it's very short. So primarily, what I'm concerned with are these two data sets. So I've kind of chosen two representative data sets, but the conclusions that you reach from these are pretty much the same conclusions that you'd reach from any other of a number of interlocking measurements that we have about cosmology. So this is a plot showing, I guess the, well, it's basically a Hubble diagram for supernovae. And this is basically the WMAP 5-year TT spectrum. So the reason I've chosen these two plots is because what they both share is that you can explain both of them if you have an epoch of cosmic acceleration. So in the supernovae case, these are basically showing you that you have some period of dark energy domination, say, in the late universe. And one explanation of the CMB spectrum is that you had something like an accelerating inflationary epoch in the early universe, although there are alternatives. Now, given that these accelerating epochs are so important in a number of cosmological models, we would desperately like to be able to explain them. And today, what I want to talk about are the costs you have to bear if you want to try to do that. So the earliest result, the earliest kind of accounting of this cost, was, I guess we lost the title up there a little bit, was due to Gary Gibbons in 1984. And in a conference proceedings, he proved a theorem which said that if you want to obtain a four-dimensional De Sitter universe from compactification, and you have a possibly warped reduction on a closed compact manifold, to obtain this De Sitter universe, you have to violate the strong energy condition in your higher dimensional theory. Now, this was important at the time because what Gary Gibbons was mostly thinking about were supergravities where you weren't allowed to violate the strong energy condition. Now, there's a number of ways, this is a powerful result, so there are a number of different ways people have found to get around it, mostly by violating one of the hypotheses of the theorem. So a selection of possibilities, you could consider manifolds which are time dependent. You could consider expansion in four dimensions, which is not De Sitter. We don't actually have any data that tells us expansion has to be exactly De Sitter at any point. You could just accept strong energy condition violation in your higher dimensional theory. This is something that sort of depends on what kind of model you're working within. Another class of exceptions are cases where the extra dimensions are not compact. So there you have a problem with getting a finite Newton's constant. So recently, new developments are that many of these loopholes have been closed, and they've been closed by proving new theorems which weaken some of the hypotheses of the classic result. In particular, improvements in the new theorems are that the energy condition, the strong energy condition, can be weakened, which makes the theorem stronger. You can include expansion in the four-dimensional universe, which is not exactly De Sitter. And you can have compactifications that are time dependent. Now, for my talk, which energy conditions are violated is important. So just for a brief summary.
Of the transient De Sitter.
I'll get to that. That's one of the things that you improve, basically by. Yeah, I don't have it on my list, so I have another improvement. But this loophole is on there. You'll see it later on how that works. But okay, so energy conditions. So there's a number of different kind of classic energy conditions that people think about. They're all useful for various things. Today, I'm mostly concerned with these two. We've heard a lot of discussion about the null energy condition. There's also the strong energy condition. They basically have to do with certain, what the inner products of certain types of vectors are with stress energy or with the Ricci curvature. I've tried to illustrate them by showing for the perfect fluid case, the blue region here shows where with perfect fluids you've satisfied these energy conditions. Now, in this plot, it doesn't look like there's much of a difference between the strong and the null energy condition. There's only this little wedge down here. But the strong energy condition, or the null energy condition, captures a lot of physics that the strong energy condition just doesn't see. So here's a few examples of things which violate these energy conditions in red and which satisfy them in green. And so you can see that for the strong energy condition, all you need to violate it is something like a scalar field with a potential that's anywhere positive, which is not pathological at all. Something like cosmological constant will violate the strong energy condition. Something like a D-brain will violate the strong energy condition. If you want to violate the null, you have to work a little bit harder. You have to do something like have a Casimir energy, but this only violates it in a non-averaged kind of sense. You need to have some kind of negative tension object, or you need to have some kind of ghost condensate. But if you have a sort of vanilla two-derivative quantum field theory that's unitary, the null energy condition is satisfied. Now, the basic reason we have these energy conditions is because otherwise everything is a solution of Einstein's equations. You just put in whatever metric you like, and you get, you compute the Einstein tensor, and you get a stress energy. So these are somehow a restriction on what we consider.
After you finish the sentence.
Okay, so these are basically restrictions on what we consider to be reasonable types of matter.
Can you go back to the transfer answer where you have crossed out the, where you have the improvements?
Okay.
Because my question is, have you ruled out KKLMMT?
I'll get to that. I'll ask you to be patient.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Now, the thing is that you could say, well, I shouldn't be worried about violating the null energy condition because it's just kind of a matter of aesthetics. But the thing is, when you violate it, you've opened the door to a lot of things that you may not like. So there's two sorts of things that the null energy condition protects us from, which broadly fall into the categories of causality violations and instabilities and other. So if you have matter that can violate the null energy condition, oftentimes you can do things like build warp drives, traversable wormholes, time machines, et cetera. Also, if you have matter that violates the null energy condition, you can have certain kinds of instabilities, certain kinds of big rip singularities. You can build perpetual motion machines with black holes, things like that. Now, this isn't to say that if you have any matter that violates the null energy condition, then you can automatically do all these things. But what it does say is that as soon as you start messing around with the null energy condition, you're sort of like in a bad neighborhood where you have to keep like looking around you and not wandering down the wrong alleyway where things can get really bad very quickly. So you have to be careful. So in this talk, I'm going to take the position that the null energy condition is something that we ought to respect. So there's basically two kinds of new no-go theorems. The first type is concerned with de Sitter. Exact de Sitter expansion in four dimensions. And I'm not going to say too much about this in this talk, but basically, in these cases, you can show you must violate the null energy condition in your higher dimensional theory under a broad set of circumstances. What I do want to talk a little bit about are the theorems having to do with W greater than one expansion in four dimensions, because they're basically of an essentially different nature than the old no-go theorems. What these new theorems tell you is that for each number k of extra dimensions that you have, there's a corresponding threshold equation of state in four dimensions. Now, below the threshold, there's a bound n on the number of e-foldings that you're allowed. That's e-foldings of expansion at some constant equation of state. If you have a constant equation of state in four dimensions and you violate this bound, then you must have violated an energy condition in the higher dimensional theory. And I'll tell you which ones in a moment. If you have W that varies with time, then these theorems give you a method for determining the corresponding e-folding bound for any W variation. But you can also sort of have the simpler result that if you have a W that varies with time, but it's always bounded above by a W star, which is constant, then the number of e-foldings you can get by varying W is always less than the number that you get from the bounding W star. So there's these two kinds of theorems. And to prove them, you need to know which of two kinds of categories your compactification manifold falls into. So I'm going to divide every compactification manifold into one of these two categories. This category is those manifolds which have everywhere vanishing intrinsic Ricci scalar curvature. This category are those for which the Ricci scalar curvature is non-vanishing somewhere on the manifold. So in the second category, we have a few different types of compactifications. This is perhaps today more of historical interest. If you want to realize gauge symmetries in four dimensions, the gauge group you get is the isometry group of your compact space. It turns out that if you have a non-abelian continuous isometry, you can't be Ricci flat. So you probably fall into this category. The other class of models are those with two extra dimensions, which a lot of people here work on, where you have some brains located at conifold curvature singularities in the extra dimensions. So you get something like a rugby ball in six dimensions. And those fall into the curve category. Now the curvature free category, as a mathematical restriction, is very strong. But as a physical restriction, it's not so bad. It includes all models of one-dimensional extra dimensions, because a one-dimensional manifold is always flat. It includes tori that are realized as periodic identifications of the plane. There's also an interesting theorem that tells you that if you're a torus and you have everywhere non-negative Ricci scalar curvature, then you are a flat torus. So tori with everywhere non-negative Ricci curvature fall in here too. Some really interesting categories also is in the curvature-free category are a number of special holonomy manifolds, such as those with symplectic or spin 7 special holonomy. Also, those with special unitary holonomy, such as the Calabi-Yau manifolds, and those with G2 holonomy, like the ones you need in M theory. So I have two kinds of theorem and two kinds of class of manifold. So there's sort of a grid that I can use to tell you what you can show. So the black box is what was known in 1984 from Gary's proof. Basically said, if you have exact de Sitter expansion, you have to violate the strong energy condition in your higher dimensional theory. So you can refine this a little bit. In the curvature-free category, if you have de Sitter expansion, you can show that you have to violate the null energy condition in your higher dimensional theory. If you have exact de Sitter expansion and you're on a curved compactification, you also have to violate the null energy condition in the higher dimensional theory, subject to a single restriction, called the bounded average condition, which takes a slide or two to define, but suffice it to say that if you have any warping and the warp function and curvature on the extra dimensions are bounded, then you satisfy this condition. Now, for the W greater than 1 case, or the transient case, if you're in the curvature-free category, you have to violate the null energy condition in the higher dimensional theory if you exceed the E-folding bound that I will define later. In the curved category, you're allowed to have a few E-foldings before you violate the strong energy condition. So the block I'm going to talk about today is basically this block here. So I'm going to try to give a feeling for how you prove this particular block. But there's different techniques depending on which block you're in.
But if the null, if you want W to be less than...
So if W is greater than minus 1,
yeah,
there's a bound... so let's say you have expansion at W equals minus 0.9. Yeah. So there's a function which tells you what the number of E-foldings that you're allowed to have at W is minus 0.9 before you violate the null energy condition. But you can have a thousandth of an E-folding, but you can't have 100 E-foldings.
Yeah, and this is only to the negative values of W, right? So
it's not W is a third, it's negative, close to
from
zero.
That'll
get answered in the slide too. But it's think about it as close to de Sitter expansion in four dimensions. Okay, so first of all, this seems kind of crazy because why do I need to violate the null energy condition? There's lots of potentials you can write down in four dimensions that give you accelerated expansion but don't have any topologies. So there's a simple example which shows how this happens. A simple example is basically taking a very simple compactification where you have Friedman, Robertson, Walker universe with a Jordan frame scale factor, Ricci flat extra dimensions, which evolve via a breathing mode. You just figure out what the four-dimensional Einstein frame scale factor is in terms of the Jordan frame one and the breathing mode modulus. In your four-dimensional universe, you apply the Friedman equations, which tell you what the kinetic energy of this volume modulus is, and so it gives it as a function of time. And you just assume that you don't have any other matter and that somehow you've generated the appropriate potential to get the equation of state that you want. But now I have the time dependence of A, and I have the time dependence of psi, and I have a relation between big A, psi, and A. So I really know everything about my higher dimensional metric. So the thing is, this is an example of something where nothing seems to be going wrong. All I need is a potential that looks something like that. And from a four-dimensional perspective, there doesn't seem to be anything that goes wrong if I make W as close to minus 1 as I want. I'm just tuning a potential to be flat. But as I said, I know all the components of my higher dimensional metric, so I can figure out, using the Einstein equations, what stress energy I needed in order to get this metric. What you find out is something like this. So here is the thing that you calculate to tell if the null energy condition is satisfied. It's violated if this is negative, which is everything below this line. Now, the solution here has two branches. One of the branches always violates the null energy condition in the higher dimensional theory, regardless of my value of W. The other branch only violates it if I'm close to De Sitter, but can satisfy it if I'm sufficiently far away. The threshold that tells me how close I can get to De Sitter is given by this function here. And it tells me that, for example, if I have one extra dimension, this is minus 7/9, it tells me I can't get any closer to that than that to De Sitter without violating the null energy condition. So the lesson from this simple example is that just because you're doing something that looks reasonable in four dimensions doesn't mean that when you lift it up to a higher dimensional theory that what you've done is consistent. Somehow, by tuning this potential to be flat, you've passed some kind of threshold that's not visible using four-dimensional physics, but means that there's some kind of pathology in the extra-dimensional theory. Okay, so to generalize this, you need to add in a lot more ingredients. Basically, the assumptions that go into the theorems are that you compactify in a closed and compact manifold, or one which is a quotient of a closed compact manifold by a discrete group. So you can include boundaries, but only those that arise from orbifolding. You assume you have a warped compactification with warp factor omega, otherwise arbitrary metric on the extra dimensions. For the particular block I'm talking about, I'm just going to assume this is a Ricci flat metric. Assuming you have a higher dimensional action with an Einstein-Hilbert term means you also include theories with couplings like this to the Ricci scalar and f of r models, which all become Einstein-Hilbert after conformal transformation. I want to emphasize that you don't need to assume anything about the matter, other matter fields that you have in your theory. So there's more going on here than just moduli dynamics. Now all the statements I make about four-dimensional cosmologies, I'm always going to be talking about the four-dimensional Einstein frame metric. Now, there's a lot of claims I'm going to need to make to explain how this works. And basically, I have a little blue dot that says, that's going to denote when I say something non-trivial that's proven in one of the papers, but that I don't have time to talk about right now. So these are the assumptions you make, and you basically have three tools to try to prove these results. So the first tool that you have is a certain decomposition of the metric in the extra-dimensional space. This is a tool that you need because you don't always know an explicit moduli space description of your higher dimensional spacetime. So as a stand-in, you can use these functions which basically parameterize how your extra-dimensional metric is evolving. That this makes sense is something that you have to show. The next tool that you have is a one-parameter family of averages on the extra-dimensional space. The family is parameterized by this number A, which you can set however you like. And what the averages do is they take any quantity and they basically average it over the manifold with a weight factor, with a weight function, which is determined by the warp and this parameter A that you have. The third tool that you have are a pair of probes, you might call them. And these are quantities that, if they're negative anywhere, show that the null energy condition must be violated. And this is something that you have to prove. But it should seem reasonable because basically what this is doing is taking the pressure, or the energy density, and what these are doing is taking the average pressure along various directions. These pi's are projectors along either the compact or non-compact directions. So if these are negative anywhere, the null energy condition is violated. Now, here's your tools. There's a number of other challenges that you have to overcome. The four-dimensional cosmology doesn't uniquely determine how the extra dimensions evolve. You don't have an explicit moduli space description in the general case. There's some issues with ghosts that you have to track down, various arbitrary functions, et cetera, et cetera. These are all things that you can take care of. Right. Okay, so I said we had these probes. So if you take them and average them over the manifold with this particular weight function, you get expressions that look like this, where you have to look in the paper. Xi and sigma are parameters which tell you how your extra-dimensional metric is evolving. Rho t and pt are the total energy density and pressure in your four-dimensional theory. So there's one or two things I want you to note about these expressions. The first thing is that if these are negative, the null energy condition is violated. Now, any metric deformations enter this first one with a minus sign. So if your metric is evolving, it makes it harder to satisfy the null energy condition. Second thing is that for an accelerating universe, both of these contributions are negative definite, which means that if you don't do anything else, you don't have any metric evolution, you're automatically going to violate the null energy condition in your higher dimensional theory. The third thing is, I have a lot of coefficients here of all these arbitrary functions, but their coefficients depend on this averaging parameter A that I have. My warp factor enters in here. So you might think I have a problem because I can always set my warp factor to do whatever I want. And finally, although this condition only depends on psi and sigma, this coefficient, or this term, depends on the time derivative of this parameter, which becomes important in proving the transience constraints. OK. The strategy you follow to prove the theorems is basically what game theorists would think about as a minimax strategy. So what you try to do is you try to minimize the maximum number of e-folds that you can get consistent with the null energy condition. And the way you do that is by looking at those two expressions that I had and noting that to keep them positive, you have to satisfy these conditions where the C's are all functions of A. So the idea is you search for a value of A for which all of these coefficients are positive. Then all of these arbitrary functions make positive contributions to the right-hand side and mean that psi has to evolve with time faster and faster. But psi evolving with time faster and faster means that eventually you run afoul of this condition here. So one of these conditions is making psi evolve faster. The other condition wants to keep psi small. Eventually those two conflict with each other, and that's what enables you to prove the bound. So it's a non-trivial thing to show that an optimizing A always exists, one for which all these coefficients are positive. But once you have it, you know that the solution with the largest number of e-folds has to satisfy these equations with the arbitrary function set to zero and with the inequalities saturated. That gives you a very simple differential equation that the optimal solution satisfies, where these alphas are functions of the number of dimensions you have, and so on. So you just have to solve this equation to find the bound on the number of e-foldings that you have. And I'm just going to skip to the answer. And the answer looks something like this. So in the Ricci-Flack case, these are the number of e-foldings you're allowed for various values of w. So for example, you can see here that if I have a large value of w that's far from de Sitter, I have an infinite number of e-foldings that I'm allowed. But there's a threshold, and if I go below the threshold, like let's say I'm at minus 0.9, I'm only allowed a small number of e-foldings before I have to violate an energy condition in my higher dimensional theory. What I especially want you to note is that in these bounds, the maximum number of e-foldings that I've plotted is 2. So this is a very small number of e-foldings. It's not 100 or 1,000. It's a few if you're close to the sitter. Another way to look at this is by plotting, as a function of the number of extra dimensions, the various bounds on W. Below this solid line, you're only allowed transient expansion. Below the dashed line, you have less than one e-folding that you're allowed. For the Ricci-Flack case, which I've been talking about, you can focus on this top plot here. What's interesting about this is that the transients is that basically this one e-folding limit is so far from de Sitter. So for example, if I take a simple inflationary model where I have a constant equation of state, then I'm constrained to be somewhere down here in W. So I need to have a W that's less than about minus 0.97. So this says that within the context of the theories I'm talking about, you can't have anywhere close to 60 e-foldings with the right value of W and satisfy the null energy condition. So to wrap up, I hope I've at least made you suspect that in the de Sitter case, you can greatly weaken the energy conditions that you need to violate in order to get accelerated expansion. When W is greater than 1, there are some new bounds which bound the number of e-foldings that you're allowed to have. What I like about this particular approach is that usually we say we're learning about high energy physics in cosmology by constructing models and seeing what we have to do to explain the data. But here you can kind of invert that question and make statements about broad classes of models based on very simple pieces of cosmological data, such that the universe is accelerating. This last bullet point gets to Robert's question. It basically means if you're a model in this category, you have a challenge to explain how you're violating one of these energy conditions, like the null energy condition, in a sensible way. Now, just to answer, now to answer the question you're asking, so one thing about the flux compactification is that there aren't any completely consistent top-down constructions which show how everything fits together in 10 dimensions and in 4 dimensions. So what this is saying is that in these models, you have to have some kind of something that violates null energy condition. There are some, one example of something that does that in string theory is something like an oriented fold plane. And this is something that you can use in these flux compactifications in certain cases. So the KKLT example is something which satisfies the hypotheses of the theorem, and at least in certain the cases that we understand sufficiently well also satisfies the conclusions of the theorem. So to the extent that you believe that in string theory you're allowed to violate this energy condition consistently, these compactifications are fine. All right, so I'll stop there. Thanks.
What about if there aren't, this can't be mapped in extra dimension if it's just four dimensional scaling?
No, that is fine. But it's, you know, like, there are, for example, in supergravity, it's not hard to make a super vacuum if you just have n equals one four dimensional supergravity. How it comes when you add in the extra dimensions.
So this isn't a problem for dark energy as such. You're really thinking inflation that this is.
Well, actually, originally I was thinking of dark energy.
But one e-folding is more than enough to explain the data, so.
Well, I don't actually know that the answer to that question yet. For example, if you look at, like, as one example, if you just take the WMAP bound to minus 0.9 at face value, the plots I showed you get much less than one e-folding. You get like a third or a quarter or something like that.
Well, you know, if you think that redshift acceleration is 0.5 or 0.6, so that's, I don't know what that is in e-foldings, but it's 0.2 of an e-folding or something. Yes.
But then you would have to stop accelerating really soon.
Yeah.
You're predicting that this acceleration is going to stop soon.
I think I'll comment on that.
You say that that normal inflation as we know it with the W first dimension, etc., is hardly compatible with extra dimension.
Well, it means that if you want to have accelerated expansion that's supposed to consider the four dimension,
yeah,
you have to solve a harder problem if you embed it in a higher dimensional context. And in particular, if you have a compactification which is curvature free, then you have to violate the null energy condition in the higher dimensional theory, even though you don't see any apparent violations before the null.
So if I keep the volume of the extra dimension fixed during inflation, are you saying that in the higher dimension I'm going to?
It turns out that's the worst thing you can do.
Okay.
And here's an exercise, right? So go back to your office and you write down a metric. And you have a De Sitter metric plus something which is time independent, yeah. And then you compute the stress energy. Then you find that you have null energy condition violation. You get something which has an energy density, negative pressure with W is minus one, and then something like minus two times the energy density as the pressure along the compact direction.
Okay, I think and the speaker again.